Welcome to San Diego News Fix, the backstory. I'm Luis Cruz. San Diego Gas and Electric is making a case before the California Public Utilities Commission to increase rates starting next year. SDG&E says it needs money for critical projects like wildfire safety and pursuing clean energy goals. But many San Diegans are frustrated with rising gas and electric bills. The average price for electricity in the San Diego metropolitan area is currently higher than anywhere else in the country. Given that tension, could asking for higher rates right now backfire? Joining us now to talk about some of the challenges of reporting on this story is Union Tribune Money reporter Roxana Popescu, topic editor Dan Berkey, managing editor Laura Sacallo, and we begin with publisher and editor Jeff Flight. Jeff?
Okay, thank you, Luis. Really interesting story, Roxana, and quite well reported, in my opinion. And I guess what I'm going to want to get at in today's conversation is how these stories come about and the role of different players, in particular, in this case, the PR people for a company or a utility that we're engaging with, and how they try to make information available or shape that information or shape the context or occasionally to shape the story, some of which I think was being attempted in this case. But let's just start at the beginning. Just describe a little bit the story that ran last weekend on our website and in our paper.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, and thanks, Luis. So this story was an interesting and a challenging one to report. I was looking at this question of optics and mixed in with ethics, mixed in with decision making by SDG&E to raise its rates because for the reasons that Luis just mentioned, right? They have a lot of projects coming up from wildfire safety to cybersecurity. And so they need more revenue, so they're making a case to the CPUC, California Public Utilities Commission, to get more money from its ratepayers, from its customers. Now, what's tricky right now to ask for more money is that this is sort of consumers are feeling that as salt on the wound, right? It's not the first time that the utility is asking for higher rates, but it's coming at a very awkward time to make that request for a couple of reasons. You know, rates have been particularly high. There was a recent surge in natural gas prices, for example. Also, you know, consumers have been hurt by a really tough economy, right? Inflation and people lining up at food banks and high rents. And so to ask for more right now is going to fall very differently than, you know, asking for it in a different environment. And also I think there's been just mounting frustration and mounting momentum on the part of consumers to push back and a feeling that their concerns have fallen on deaf ears. Now, SDG&E's leadership has spoken up about affordability. There was an op-ed, a commentary published in the Union Tribune last year where SDG&E's CEO, Carolyn Nguyen, had talked about ways that they could bring value or bring savings to consumers. So that's on their mind. But this story looked at, I guess maybe the question of, I'll just use that word, fairness, you know, this and imbalances between what one organization is earning and what other people are being asked to give. And of course, people don't know the inner workings of how utility functions. And there's a lot of context and a lot of nuance. But even without knowing that, there's this gut feeling of we are giving too much. We can't give any more right now. It's what's that expression? Squeezing something from a something. There's just nothing else we can give. Right. Somebody fill in the blanks there for me.
Yeah. So it's in stone.
Thank you. That's what it is. Yeah. Great. I was like, fill in the blanks. Yeah, thanks, Dan. So it's not a good look. And so I talked to different stakeholders from, you know, utility analysts, people who are ratepayer kind of advocates, talked to people who have worked on regulatory kind of proceedings more from my education, from my background, and of course also reached out to SDG&E and to its parent company, Sempra.
Yeah. So good background. And, you know, to me, the topic of the story really is this point where a big company, is meeting low-income customers, right? So they're selling to people of limited means, and it's sort of an income inequality story, right? You've got this vast rate base, which includes many people with very limited means, and then you have this company that has profits in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and executives, another sore point in the story, who are making many, many millions of dollars a year. All those things coming together around, oh, my bill. And of course, you know, I think those circumstances exist not just in the utility world, but in other parts of our economy that have been created tensions as well. But before we get to that, Roxana, just tell me, like, as a reporter, you are dealing with PR people for government or quasi-government organizations like this one, or private companies, routinely, right? Like, how does that work? What does a reporter do, and typically, what does a PR person do?
Yeah, definitely. I'm happy to answer that. In my experience, it's a two-way street where I'll get approached with ideas from PR professionals. You know, whether they're from PR companies or from independent companies or from working for in-house. And then in turn, I also go to them and ask for help on stories. You know, for example, access to a certain person that I'd like to interview, or from some data or statistics. So they're kind of a what's the word? Like they're in some cases they're standing between me and the thing that I want, and they help me get it. In some cases they're standing there and they might, for various reasons, tell me that thing that I want is inaccessible. Sometimes it's that they need more time to get something, and you know that will shape the way the story is reported. You know, I need more time on that deadline. Sometimes they say, we can't get you that information, and that might, I have to find a different way to get it, or I need to push back or ask why. So there's a lot of different ways that dialogue can play out.
Right. So like from us, from the journalism side of the table.
Yeah.
We're thinking of these PR people as people who will help make information available from, in this case, the company. Hey, I've got all these different kinds of questions. Could you get me the answers from the executives, or just the factual data that I need to build my story? And but sometimes I think it becomes clear that from their side of the table, the PR people are tasked with not just providing information, but being concerned with how that information is going to be used, right? They're worried about the reputation of the company. So how does that interplay work?
Yeah, certainly. I think that the question of shaping a story, in various conversations with PR people, they there's this hope that if they come earlier into the conversation as I'm creating the list of story questions or the direction that a story might go in, there's a hope that they will have more say. What's the emphasis? What am I de-emphasizing? So that's one way that it can play out. Go ahead and hit me with another question. Right direction. Like, what am I covering? Yeah, please go.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked that is because, I think that happened here, right? Somebody didn't like the questions you were asking, and I think became concerned, hey, this could cast our company in a bad light, or this could run crosswise to our business goals of achieving a rate increase, which is important for us to operate our utility, by talking about things that could inflame public sentiment or create a political environment where profits of utilities might be under pressure. So I guess just, what did happen here as you proceeded on the story?
Yeah, I think this is actually a really interesting case study. I mean, I'm a part of it, so it's hard for me to report on it objectively. But if I step back for a second, of different types of PR/reporter interactions, like we saw multiple facets of that dynamic in one story. So in this being SDG&E and Sempra on one side and myself on the other, Union Tribune on the other. So we had, for example, a good working relationship where I asked questions and questions were answered, right? That was one type of interaction we had. That's sort of that's the best case scenario for a reporter, all the way to within the same story, being asked to not publish a story and being sort of told that my understanding of the topic was not adequate and that I'd not reported it sort of in conformance with how they thought the story should be reported, and that we should really not publish the story as based on the impression they had that this, of what the story was going to be from the questions I was asking. So that's pretty wide gamut of everything from, I have a question, okay, here's the answer, to don't publish the story. And that on that, and I can get into a couple of intermediate steps or, you know, areas, but on the don't publish side, you know, that was spoken both to me and also, you know, there were conversations between editors. I mean, it was a pretty robust campaign to try to tamp down or to prevent the story from going forward, the story that they thought was being published from going forward. Obviously, they didn't have a draft. They didn't have an outline. They're just going on the impression they had from conversations that they had with me in emails. So that's sort of a broad overview of kind of the different dynamics that played out within about a week of interactions with, I mean, I've interacted with them for more than a week, but just in this story, it took about a week for things to go from, well, let's talk, here's some, we're happy to answer your questions, send them over to don't publish.
Yeah. Yeah. Any follow-up since publication, retraction demands, commentary, feedback?
They have not said anything, you know, they've not expressed concerns with the way the story was written or reported. I sent them an email, as I do actually after every story. I email all the sources. I thank them for their interviewer materials, and I welcome their feedback and ideas for future coverage. And I did not hear back on that email.
Okay, so let's talk to Dan and Laura for a minute. So Dan, as a business editor at a number of different outlets over your career, I'm sure you've dealt with this kind of dynamic before. What have your interactions been when people are worried about a story coming, you know, from that PR end?
Roxanne is describing a model that's become, you know, prevalent in corporate America, more so in the last 25, 30 years. I saw it develop out in Silicon Valley. I think some of the, you know, better examples today might be Uber, Tesla, companies facing, you know, tough questions, often employ a model where their initial response to a reporter is, you can't use any of this. I'm going to talk to you off the record. Here's a bunch of information that should convince you not to do the story, or it is not the story you think it is. And at the point where that doesn't work and specific questions are being asked, and can I talk to so-and-so within your company who is the expert on this? The answer is often no, they're not available. Show me your questions. And we see the questions, we may go one direction, which is, you know, terse answers to selected questions, or the other one, which is, we're not answering these, you're way off base. You know, you're going down the wrong rat hole here. So to me, a little bit of the context here is control. I mean, that's what this is all about. And I mentioned Silicon Valley. I thought it was interesting how Silicon Valley came to employ this strategy more and more as companies felt they had more control and could exert control. Because, you know, I mean, there was a time, Steve Jobs is the famous example of somebody who would not give interviews or had very tight press access. You know, he was going to determine what photographer took his picture, if anybody. That was true when Steve Jobs was powerful. There was a point in Steve Jobs's, you know, career arc where he went to start another company, Next Inc., after he left Apple, and he needed the press to some extent, and he was available. I have in my Rolodex, some of you will remember what a Rolodex is, I have a phone number for Steve Jobs, you know, back in the day, because he needed access. A lot of companies feel like they don't need the press as much these days. In the case of Tesla, which is like way out on the other end of the scale, their CEO is constantly tweeting everything he thinks about, you know, his company or the world. And they laid off their PR staff because the PR staff was essentially there just to tell people go away. And, you know, I think they realized they didn't need somebody to do that. Their CEO was doing a fine job of it.
Can I jump in? Can I jump in and say, thanks. Yeah. On what Dan just described, that phenomenon of the background conversation. That's actually what happened here. So one of the conversations I had with an SDG&E PR professional, we talked for maybe 40 minutes. He gave me a lot of great material, and it was, you know, I wish I could quote, you know, every other word, but, you know, there's a lot of material that would have really helped shape parts of the story. I mean, to go into providing counterpoint and information and context for readers. I mean, it was a good conversation, but it was all on background. And there's also, you know, he shared some documents with me for me to do more reading. Unfortunately, this was at about, I'm going to guess, 2 p.m. on a Friday. The story was due, you know, around 2 p.m. on a Friday. I mean, it was really tight. So for me to then go and do even more get more documentation, more reading after having worked on it for many weeks, you know, it was, that kind of conversation could have happened earlier, and I wish it were not on background. It's just sort of, it puts the reporter, I think, and it tries to put the reporter in a difficult position of, you know, playing catch up, not being, anyway, I'm kind of fumbling with that. Essentially, you know, if the material had been put on the record, if it were an open conversation, we would have had a different story. You know, it would have been a different outcome. So that gambit was, I think that's where things kind of twisted or turned in the reporting of that story with them.
I think when that kind of thing happens, it's also an open question. Is this information here to better inform me? Mm-hmm. Certainly possible and very important. Or is this information being pushed across the desk to me at the 11th hour to put me in conflict so that later it could be claimed, well, she wasn't prepared. She hadn't been through all the documents, mm-hmm. which, of course, can be a very successful tactic if you've got a complicated topic and there's an endless list of documents that could come across your desk at the 11th hour. So
you should have seen how many tabs I had open. I mean, any reporter, right? When you're reporting something, it's like, you know, computer crash level number of tabs. I mean, lots of research for that. You know, of course, I mean, that's what reporters do. So, right. But to hit a reporter on the, you know, you're not informed, you don't know enough, that's really going at the nerve, the jugular of a reporter, right? That's how to undermine our, what we're supposed to do. Our job is to be informed and to source, you know, to do that deep work to get in a position where we can write with authority.
And right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, and in our mind, it's contradictory in the sense that the very exercise we're undergoing here is to find people no more than we do, mm-hmm. and can inform us. And when we're being told we can't talk to those people, or that information is not available, or you can't use those things I just told you, it seems to fight that idea that we want to be better informed.
Completely. And by the way, I mean, to be told that I don't know enough about a topic, I mean, I know I don't know enough about a topic. I'm not coming from a position of, oh, I know everything about this, and that's why I published. I mean, it's, or, you know, that's why we, in other words, there's always a position, I'm in a position of curiosity and of humility and, you know, always learning more. I don't, you know, I think that's an important distinction to make there, or important disclaimer, you know, it's not a position of arrogance and I know everything. I mean, a reporter, to be told you don't know enough about a story will obviously make a reporter, you know, yikes, because yeah, I'm always worried that I don't know and there's more I should know. So I think that's very, you know, a very fair concern. I mean, I'm always asking, do I know enough to be able to go with the story? Is it ready to run? You know, in fact, the same story didn't, you know, for a week earlier, it wasn't ready to run. So we ran it, we took more time to report it. And when it ran, it was ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, obviously, we need to know enough to evaluate the answers that we're getting to questions. But the job of a reporter is not to know the answers. The job is to ask the questions. So we don't need to know how to run a utility to ask questions about how utilities are run. This is a great topic, and we could go on all day. But I just wanted to get to Laura Sicalo. You two, as managing editor, have been at the other end of these kinds of phone calls where somebody might be saying, hey, I'm concerned about the questions a reporter is asking. I'm worried that it indicates that that their story will be uninformed or unbalanced. Those are, I think, are legitimate questions. Wouldn't you share with me just a little of your recent experiences on contentious stories like this one?
Well, as you say, there have been many instances where I've been the recipient of those phone calls or those emails, just as you have. And I think Roxana makes an excellent point. One way to really either get under the skin of a reporter or an editor or to undermine is to question not necessarily their expert knowledge on a subject, but do they know enough to be asking the right questions, or are those questions that they're asking leading in the right direction? Similarly, just as easy to undermine to say what the questions that are being asked reflect a bias, and we're concerned because we have every reason to believe this story is not going to be fair based on the conversations that we're having. And in our discussions with Roxana in advance of this story running, I was reminded of, you know, our own experiences with the Ash Street stories, very similar. And I recalled a conversation that Jeff McDonald, the reporter on those stories, and his immediate editor and I had in early 2020, in which there were probably six city officials or representatives on this call, all explaining how we didn't understand, Jeff didn't understand the story, and kind of a litany in verse and all the ways that he was wrong about any assumptions he was making or the direction of the questions. And a line that just has rung in my head over and over again was one of the officials from the city saying, you know, this deal was constructed similarly to the Civic Center Plaza deal. And little did we know at the time how true that was and how that too should have been a red flag. But it was presented as there's a lack of understanding. We have, you know, this is not a new way to structure these deals and everything is fine. And there was a very concerted effort in multiple places, I think, to kind of derail Jeff's reporting. And concerns along the way about whether or not we were on the right track or were being fair. And I think it's always good for us to take a step back, make sure we are being fair, to take a breath and have those conversations internally. And I think we did that. We did that with Roxana's story. We certainly did it with Ash Street. Prior to that, we had very similar kinds of pressures around the Duke Cunningham story, and lots of instances of being told we were off track, didn't know enough, didn't understand the process, didn't understand you know, the defense contracting and how all that worked. And so I think there are certainly efforts, especially when somebody is concerned about their organization, their company, their livelihood. There is a lot of pressure to be applied to a reporter who may be digging where they don't want anyone digging.
Yeah. And I'll just share as a sort of a final thought. Like, I really feel like that tactic is very undermining to the PR professional community, because I had that same conversation with a high-ranking person in the Duncan Hunter circle. I guess I'll put it that way to not out the person completely. All about how, hey, Jeff, between you and me, totally confidentially, I just want to share with you, this Morgan Cook doesn't know what she's doing. These stories about the congressman's campaign contribution disclosures, totally wrong and off base. You really ought to be, you know, not be going there. Okay, so that tactic, which I think Dan described, of trying to have the secret confidence to undermine the story by telling lies to the journalist, that's a terrible thing to do, because we do need to know when we're wrong. We do need to know when we're off base. But when self-interested people use those tactics, it obviously undermines efforts in the future to have clear and honest communication. So we can put that in our journalism textbook for the day, I guess. Thank you, team. Very interesting conversation and a very good story as well, Roxana. Luis?
Thank you very much, Jeff. And thank you to Laura, Roxana, and Dan. That does it for this edition of The Backstory. You can read more of Roxana Popescu's reporting on this topic on our website, sandiegouniontribune.com. For everyone at the San Diego Union Tribune, thank you very much for listening and for supporting local journalism. Have a great day, everybody.